It's the Pop-O-Matic Podcast for June 22nd, 2016. Coming to you from Studio MPL in downtown Nashville, this is the Pop-O-Matic Podcast, where you can rock out with your library card out and proud. I'm Jeremy, and joining me today are...
Clem Marie.
Bill.
Mike.
Amanda.
This week, Nashville marks Pride Week with its annual two-day festival and concert down at the Public Square Park, June 24th and June 25th. And we are celebrating library style with some books and probably some other materials. We will also have a booth at the Pride Fest, and
where you can get a library card.
That's right, and you can rock out with it. We would be remiss to not acknowledge that we're doing this in the sort of the shadow of a national tragedy. But the show must go on, and we are going to go on and on and on. Clem Marie.
Yes, hi. I have a YA, a young adult novel for you today called Aristotle and Dante Discover the Secrets of the Universe by Benjamin Alire Sáenz. If you want to anglicize that pronunciation, Benjamin Alire Sáenz. Well, anyhow, Aristotle and Dante Discover the Secrets of the Universe is a story of two teenage boys, Aristotle, known as Ari, and Dante. Both are Mexican-American, and they strike up a friendship. But also, but as their friendship develops and everything, Dante becomes very open about his homosexuality while Aristotle suppresses his. So it's a coming of age story. It's also a story of identity, what it means to be Mexican American, and also a story of family, love, and acceptance. It's a beautiful book. It's one of the most beautiful books I've ever read. It's very lyrical because it's sort of written in vignettes. Some chapters are longer than others and everything. And if you're looking for, also the book has also won some awards for its representation of gay and lesbian characters. So if you want to read a really beautiful book that's written for young adults, but also I think very appropriate for adults about identity, family, friendship, coming of age, and also being accepted by one's family and accepting one's own self, read Aristotle and Dante Discover the Secrets of the Universe. And I really love this book.
I feel like YA books get a bad rap because you think, oh, they're just for teenagers. I'm not gonna, but I've read a lot of good YA books.
Yes, there are some really good YA books out there that are just as good, if not better, than some adult books I've read. And I think, there's profound wisdom, as someone who works with children's literature, profound wisdom in children's books. And I think also in books for teenagers. And like a YA book, this was a shorter read.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes that helps, too. It doesn't pound the concept into your head.
I think it's, some grown-up folks may need a YA book, mm-hmm, in order to get into something or to learn about something. But I really enjoyed this book. So Aristotle and Dante Discover the Secrets of the Universe. If you're looking for something at the intersection of identity, sexuality, Mexican-American identity, family, and friendship, read this book. It's available in print and in ebook version in our library. I also want to say it's an audiobook, but I read the ebook version, but I really enjoyed it. Bill.
In 1975, one of my favorite movies was released, Dog Day Afternoon, starring Al Pacino, John Cassell, and Charles Durning, written by Frank Pearson and directed by Sidney Lumet. The movie is based on the strange true story of John Wojtkowicz, a homosexual who robs a bank so his male wife could have a sex change operation.
This is Brian.
After we recorded this episode, I said to Bill, do you think a movie where the lead is a sociopath that has not come to terms with his own sexuality and commits a violent crime, a crime involving many guns, was the right choice for this particular Pride episode? And Bill said,
yeah, I guess you're right. But Dog Day Afternoon is such a good movie.
And I said, okay.
At this time, Al Pacino was at the height of his box office popularity and at the top of his acting game. He was coming off both Godfather pictures, Serpico, both huge artistic and box office successes. The director, Sidney Lumet, said he thought Al Pacino was extremely brave to do the role because of his most recent successes. One must remember this was still the early 1970s. Sidney Lumet said that the theme of the Dog Day Afternoon was the freaks are just like us. He wanted the cast to play the characters as natural and realistically as humanly possible. I once attended a film festival in Virginia where Frank Pearson, the screenwriter of Dog Day Afternoon, also attended. They showed had a screening of Dog Day Afternoon, and he stated, while researching the movie, everyone he interviewed who knew the actual bank robber, John Watahowicz, said they were let down by him because he was always trying to please people. He had this ability to think he could help anybody in the situation, and this is his default in character, and it becomes his downfall in the movie. Also at the same festival was the actual bank robber Al Pacino played John Watahowicz. And to put it bluntly, he was a bit of a sad figure, overweight, and he sat in a wheelchair. However, he seemed to have a very outgoing personality. Well, let me change that. He was just nuts. Very entertaining, but nuts. If you go on YouTube and look at the old television footage of the real bank robbery, he looks like Al Pacino, and that's why Warner Brothers wanted to make the movie, because he looked like Al Pacino, and Pacino was the hottest actor in the country, which is kind of odd. Like, would a studio now make a movie like this? I mean, Warner Brothers wanted to make Dog Day Afternoon. It was their idea. At the final movie of the film festival, which was The Cooler, I was leaving the theater, and on the back row was John Watahowicz, the bank robber. And nobody was talking to him, so it's not every day you get to meet a homosexual who robs a bank so his wife can have a sex change operation, and Al Pacino plays him in a classic movie. I introduced himself. I told him how much I enjoyed him on the panel discussion. We shook hands. We had a very pleasant conversation. So I highly recommend Dog Day Afternoon. Mike?
Yeah, and wasn't there a documentary called The Dog? That was goes in more into detail about what a hoe is.
That wasn't made. That was even before when I met him, and there was a movie called The Dog, and it came to the Bell Court a few years ago.
I did a double feature of Dog Day Afternoon and The Dog.
A man doesn't regret what he does. I consider myself a romantic. When I met Ernie for the first time, it was love at first sight. And because I loved him on August 22nd, 1972, I had to do something. Nobody would ever did what I did. Nobody would ever rob a bank to give a guy a sex change operation. That's why they made a movie about it. But there's only one star, and that's me. We parked the car. Bobby dropped the shotgun. All these people are standing there, but you know, who's gonna say anything? Oh, you dropped your shotgun.
When he was a kid, he was good. I tell you what I did to him one time. I spied on him. I was down that village. See, I knew more than what he thought. Please.
I went to Chase Manhattan when I first was out, and I wanted to be a security guard. I said, I'm the guy from Dog Day Afternoon. Nobody's gonna rob the dog's bank. If I had a dream, and in that dream I saw everything that happened, would I still go out and do it? You're damn right I would still go out and do it.
It was very interesting.
Interesting guy.
He's a quirky dude, or he was.
Yeah. Oh, still is. Oh, okay. Still very much is. And it's, like I say, he was very entertaining. And that day he told things that weren't even in the documentary. Like, you know, during that, it's not a well-known fact, but according to the screenwriter at the time, Nixon was giving his speech for the Republican convention, but all the news during New York was focused on this bank robbery because this was like one of the first times that an actual event became a television show.
Oh, wow.
Now it's become so uncommon, but now at that time they had the remotes and they were able to do this. And so the movie points that out, but it said that it took away publicity and according to the bank robber, John Wojtkowicz, he said that the FBI was in orders to kill him.
Oh.
But the New York Police Department stepped in and, you know, said, no, you're not going to do that. You know, we've got him under arrest. They'd already killed one of the guys. So that's according to Wojtkowicz. And I don't think that fact was in the movie, but he told that at the film festival.
Oh, cool. Yeah. I like in the documentary, like that was only his first male wife. He's had like six or seven. And by the end, like the last guy's like, I don't like being called a wife, which made me laugh quite a bit. one book genre I never really got into is true crime. For me, at least, half the fun of TV true crime documentary shows is silly ancillary stuff, like how the narrator for Forensic Files says words with L in the middle. Files. Milk. Files.
Snapped.
You know, L. Or City Confidential combines true crime with ridiculous travelogues. This crime of passion soured the town's mood faster than the lemon custard at Lenny's Cafe. Will the jury of East Westingbird find Gary from Perth guilty? or will the prosecution's case collapse faster than the courthouse did in 1876? But books? Nah. Not even Joe Bob Briggs' book written under his own name could get me interested in the genre. But when a book called Alice Plus Frida Forever by Alexis Coe crossed my desk way back in 2014, I was not only interested in checking it out, but I was surprised that I had such a great time reading it. Unfortunately, this review will be rather spoiler-heavy, at least for my tastes, but most of the book is given away in the book jacket in the first chapter. So, you know, you have been warned.
Somebody got killed.
Yeah.
Yes.
Spoiler alert!
What?
A murder that happened in Memphis, Tennessee in 1892 shocked the entire nation. A teenager named Alice Mitchell slashed her best friend Freda Ward's throat in broad daylight. The first chapter actually goes into like real detail as Freda struggled to get away and ran for a couple blocks while Alice sliced Freda's servant and there was like blood everywhere and it was, gross. It turned out, though, that it was a crime of passion. Ooh. Freda was an incurable flirt who flirted with nearly anyone, male or female. Alice fell madly in love with her and the two were lovers for a time. Alice even made elaborate plans to dress as a man and elope with Freda. But alas, their love letters were discovered by their respective parents, and they were told to never see each other again. Alice was heartbroken and made repeated attempts to see Freda, and Freda didn't really seem to care. Whatever, dudes. She started making eyes at everybody again and eventually got really serious with the boy, which made Alice very, very angry. One of the things that really struck me about this book was how the very idea of lesbianism was so completely foreign to all the men who put her on trial, because this was Tennessee in the 1890s, and of course, they were all men. And all her protestations of love and jealousy just made her even crazier to them. It just, you know, added to the nutsoid defense. And there are a lot of asides as to how, like, women who were accused of crime in Victorian America would not really expect any sort of justice.
They were made hysterical by their uteruses, quote, yes. Yeah. Yes. Yes. Yes.
One big flaw with the book, which is... Jeremy has a uterus. One flaw with the book, which is very jarring, is that she says multiple times that Memphis is in East Tennessee. Coe blames the publisher. I mean, doing it like once, it's like, okay, fine. But like, she said it at least two or three times, and I'm like,
east of what?
It's east of the Mississippi.
Yeah. You know, well, you know, in Mirror Land, you know, you know, Knoxville,
the Zorro world,
up is down, left is right, and Nashville's into really cool music. Oh, I just thought I'd warn you. Also, I wish the book were just kind of longer. It's a very short book. It's only about 200 pages. I just blew through it. All in all, though, I had a really good time, and I totally recommend it. While Googling it this morning, I found out there's an option for a movie with Jennifer Kent of The Babadook to direct, which is pretty cool. And a special bonus for true crime fans, if you care about any book we have on murder, our special policy is to put it under the number 364.1523. So that's right. Happy hunting, gang.
It's murder.
Amanda.
Okay, so I will start by saying that I am reading Proust. And I know that you're going to ask, like, wait, that's hard, right?
I'm suddenly in the mood for a Madeleine.
I know. Yeah. I should have made Madeleines. I can make Madeleines.
Rewind.
Delicious. I have a special pan and everything.
Yeah. Ooh.
I just got a smell, and it reminded me of the day I was born.
I want to write 13 books about it.
Just 7. So I don't know. The hard is really the right choice of words to describe Proust. Complicated, maybe. Descriptive, certainly. And I will freely admit that it is long, clocking in at over 3,000 pages and roughly 1.25 million words. Just for those of you keeping score at home.
Wow.
So Proust, In Search of Lost Time, it may be one of, if not the longest novel ever written. I might argue that because, like, some of the series that I read, there's like the Diana Gabaldon series. They're like, yes. They're like 1,000 words apiece, and there's like 15 of them or something. So
how heavy a thud does the book make when you
have volume 1 and 2.
Oh,
so it's,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So that, I mean, he divided it into 7 volumes. So.
Oh.
So my reading this book actually began as a joke. Proust hit my radar because his book is a major plot point in an episode of My Beloved Gilmore Girls. And favorite character Max Medina, who is an English teacher, thank you very much, mentions that everyone should read some Proust every day. But I knew that it was long and I figured it was really hard to read, so I kind of avoided it. But then recently, a graphic novel slid across my desk. It was big, and a closer inspection revealed that it was Swan's Way, which is the first volume of this epic work. So after
calling Jeremy.
Suddenly Jeremy is interested.
Wait, there's a graphic novel?
Put on 7 holds.
So after getting over the shock that someone would actually make a graphic novel out of this, I thought, why not? If I'm ever going to read Proust, this might be the way to do it. So the story is basically Proust reconstructing his life through various memories, the most famous being, we already mentioned, the Madeleine scene, where eating a bit of cake soaked in tea brings him back to his childhood. And I enjoyed the graphic novel, but I just kind of had this feeling that I was missing something. So to compare and contrast, I actually checked out the official first volume, which is only 462 pages, so that's doable.
That's shorter than Diana Gabaldon's first book. So.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, and as I read, I found it captivating. Part of the reason that there are over 1 million words is that Proust likes adjectives. He also loves the semicolon and the colon, so there are a lot of kind of long sentences. Brian's excited.
Semicolons!
Woo! So I thought this would bug me, which is kind of why I stayed away, but if you just kind of read it and don't care exactly about where the period or the colon or whatever it is falls, it doesn't interrupt the narrative, so that works out. Now, during his life, Proust never openly admitted to being a homosexual. His family and friends may have suspected, but no one but his posthumous biographers ever actually discussed this publicly. But there are themes of homosexuality woven throughout his novel. In Search of Lost Time, first published in France in 1909, is actually the first time that this topic is openly mentioned in literature. I might argue openly. He kind of cloaks it in humor. It's funny. So the graphic novel buried this storyline, I thought, and that's part of what I didn't understand. So when I got the real book, I went, oh, that's what they were doing. Okay, I get it. The book is dense, and I can only read about 25 pages before I kind of have to take a break, but I find myself thinking about those pages when I am not reading. And originally, I only meant to read the first most popular volume, but now I think I'm going to try for the whole thing. I did finish the first one, and I'm working on the second one right now.
Well, well done.
Thank you. Baby steps. So I want to see what happens to all the characters. I actually think Proust might be a gateway drug of sorts for me. I might try James Joyce next. Maybe the Russians. You never know.
I have read Dr. Zhivago. It took forever.
They're 25 pages at a time. So with Proust, either I think you love him or you hate him. You've read him or you haven't. I've read it and I loved it. And I'm probably going to go back for more. And no one is more shocked about this than me.
Have some tea and Madeleines when you're doing it.
I didn't eat Madeleines. I need to.
R.I.P. George Harrison.
Yeah, there was a Monty Python sketch involved.
One of the books I was reading about it said that there was a Monty Python that said, tell the whole story in like 15 words or less.
That was the contestants had to explain the entire book in French, I think.
Oh,
in
probably.
Like 15 words or something.
I had to look that up online.
That's hilarious. So,
Jeremy?
Hi.
I tried to make a joke about
Edward Herman, and I said George Harriman. George Harriman is a is a cartoonist, not a...
Yeah, one was the head vampire in... Lost Boys.
That's correct. He was also the dad on Gilmore Girls.
Lost Boys.
George Harriman was a cartoonist who did Crazy Cat. Speaking of cartoonist, maybe I'm like subconsciously creating segues for myself. I'm going to talk about Howard Cruz. He's an Alabama-born cartoonist who came to prominence in the underground comic scene of the early 1970s. And in 1979, he began editing the anthology Gay Comics with an X, but he can be forgiven for that. I don't like spelling comics with an X. Come on. Give me a break. This book, that's I hate it so much. It's still comics. It doesn't matter.
It's still tricks.
They don't spell novel different when it's a piece of garbage novel and it's or Proust, right?
It's called genre.
It's comics are not.
It's called paperback.
Comics are not a genre, folks. It's a medium. Eat it.
Comics,
it's a medium. It's a medium. There we go. All right.
So it's Patricia Arquette.
I made you so angry, you
can't complete. So is anyway, Gay Comics featured the work of openly gay cartoonists. In the 1980s, Howard Cruz's strip Wendell appeared in the Advocate magazine. And in 1995, he published the book I'm going to talk about, Stuck Rubber Baby, a graphic novel which deals with the homosexuality of the main character, Toland Polk, racism in the South, and the burgeoning civil rights movement. So as young Toland Polk grows up, he finds himself reluctantly becoming a part of the civil rights movement in his hometown of Clayfield, a fictional city in the South. And he's telling a story from the present day, reflecting on the past, on the fear and denial that defines his life throughout the story. Cruz parallels Toland's fight against his own sexuality and coming to grips with who he is, with a fight to maintain the tradition, the town's fight to maintain the tradition of institutional racism. The change both in the political environment and Toland's personal life are slow going, but there is no denying them. And though the story is not autobiographical, Cruz definitely incorporated his own experiences growing up in Birmingham, Alabama, into the work. And this really makes it all that much more believable. There's a boy that he fooled around with at summer camp, a closeted bank president who was found murdered, and a school nurse that was ridiculed because of her masculine appearance. These are all things that are in the book and all came from Cruz's life. There's also a chilling scene in the book where patrons at the Rhombus, an integrated gay bar, are tipped off by a flashing red light that the police are about to arrive. And then everyone on the dance floor changes from homosexual to heterosexual dance partners. And then in a few silent panels, the police sort of assess the crowd and look them up and down. And then there's one scene that really stuck with me. Cruz depicts one of the policemen with his hat brim casting a shadow over his eyes as he walks through the crowd, and the cop is kind of looking around, and his face seems to get more shadowy, or it's just kind of scary. But his face is deep with fat, and there's like dark lines in his face, and it's really terrifying image because it's sort of in one panel he sums up this idea of like these brutal enforcers coming in to round people up and scare people. And the piano player Mabel at the bar, she says that the cops come there to, quote, keep the queers nervous. And Cruz really evokes decades of these tactics with just this one haunting panel. So this is a powerful book about tolerance and finding yourself and the struggles associated with both. It's not preachy or cheesy, or anything like that, even though what I just said was. But I can't recommend it enough. So check it out. Hey, guys.
Hi, Jeremy.
Hello, Jeremy.
What's up? What do we do on Tickle My Fancy?
Well, maybe the library has it. Maybe the library doesn't. But either way, it's tickling our fancy.
Amanda?
I get to go first. Score!
Your name sounds the best after...
It is the creepiest, because it has the most syllables.
Yeah, I think you're...
Amanda!
Okay, so I'm going to stick with our pride theme for my fancy tickle. One of the most spoken artists for the LGBTQ community cause is 80s icon Cyndi Lauper. When I was growing up, I always loved Girls Just Want to Have Fun and True Colors. Even if I thought she dressed weird, which was even harder to do in the 80s, I just wrote her off as a wacky artist and saying
it was the 80s. Everybody dressed weird.
But she was like weird even for the 80s.
That's
like,
true.
She went on beyond.
She did have an album called She's So Unusual, so yeah. She let you know.
She was proud of it, and I appreciated that. So it's been 30 years since her heyday, but Lauper really never stopped recording music. She actually just released an album on May 6th of this year. It's called Detour. It's country songs. To help with the album, Lauper enlisted friends Emmylou Harris, Willie Nelson, Vince Gill, Jewel, and Alison Krauss. And since I like most of those people, sorry, Willie.
Whoa.
Sad face.
Wow. That's when you thought she was going to throw Jewel under the bus.
Take that so hot, you can light a cigarette with that.
I know.
No, burn.
A thunder light a cigarette.
Yes.
Yeah.
Also, that is quite a country a artist pedigree over there.
Yeah, it was really good. So the album sounds exactly like how I expected an album produced in Nashville would sound, which for me makes it a little bit predictable. It's gotten a decent response from critics. It actually debuted at number 4 on Billboard's Top Country Album chart. But if I didn't know that it was Cyndi Lauper, I don't know that I would have guessed it was her. I like her song selections, but I kind of wish she would have Lauperized them a little bit more. They kind of sound pretty standard. It doesn't have the Lauper flavor that I was looking for.
If she like had some backup vocals that went, Goonies, 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 Goonies!
No, I didn't have that track. but so the library does have the CD, so if you're interested, you can check that one out for yourself. Mag?
I could not choose this one thing to recommend this week, so I'm playing with fire, recommending two. Oh, man. I'll go really quick.
I'm telling Brian.
I'm sure Undead Engineer Brian will just cut this and go like, Mike recommended garbage. What do you think, Bill? All right, so. first we.
Now it's going to happen. You just have to set that up.
I'm playing with more fire. Oh, no. First, I saw Blue Oyster Cult in Bowling Green last week, and it was transcendent,
y'all. Did
it
have enough cowbell?
No, they fired that guy.
Oh.
He may be dead, considering most of the band is. But
did he play the cowbell a little too hard?
He played cowbell to death.
Did they put him out to pasture?
That was not manure.
I thought I got that joke.
Sorry. I had to milk that one.
Okay, moving on.
Moving on. Anyway, I was...
set you up, but I still set you up.
Each Lisa me up is great. Thanks, Amanda.
You're welcome.
Or Munda.
This ain't his first rodeo.
Yeah. Yeehaw, y'all.
This is utterly amazing. Anyway,
it just keeps going, y'all.
That's no bull.
I wasn't gonna cut any of your pieces, but this pun thing, it went off for like 5 minutes all by itself.
Oh man. Oh. Okay. Anyway. Yada yada yada. Okay. So, particular highlight was the song "Buck's Boogie," which is a song whose sole purpose is to give guitarist Buck Dharma a chance to jam in his awesome Moon Crater half guitar for 6 to 10 minutes. It's amazing. We have a live version on Freego from the album On Your Feet or On Your Knees. Was that amazing, y'all? Yeah. Lastly, we're recording this the week of E3, the Electronic Entertainment Expo, which is a yearly showcase of upcoming video game hardware and software that I'm the only one this podcast who's really excited about. Woohoo! At first, I wasn't too excited for anything, really, until the announcement of a reboot of the God of War series. Ha-ha! So instead of doing my normal morning routine stuff on Tuesday, like shaving or smelling nice, I watched a 10-minute video, Kratos, slaughter of literally every single Greek god and demigod and monster. And now a Viking, I guess, showing his son how to kill mountain trolls. You and I both know that one of the Aesir is going to kill his son, or they'll whack Kratos, and Kratos Jr. will have to seek revenge. But either way, I am eagerly looking forward to ripping the head off Thor and using it as a cup for my mead. Sometime in the next year or two. I may even take a day off to play it like I did for God of War 3. God of War 3. There are multiple videos of the announcement online. I'm sure the Spectral Ghost of Brian can find one.
Nothing gets us more hyped than seeing cool upcoming stuff in the world of gaming. So let's take a look at all the greatness E3 2016 had to offer us. Here are our top 5 announcements of the show.
Back away, boy!
Sony opened its press conference with a gameplay demo of the new God of War. It showed Kratos teaching his son how to take down a series of vicious monsters. The setting is completely new and seemed to be inspired by Norse mythology.
What do you have, Bill?
Well, tickling my fancy, if you go to Google and type in every 70s movie, you will get the best, the worst, the weirdest, and every far-out thing in between. This is a blog spot by Peter Hansen that has posted a new review every day since October 19. That's not right. It's not 1970. Anyway, forget that. He covers the gambit of movies made in the 70s, including classics like Dog Day Afternoon and obscure films like Bustine and Cry Uncle. If you like 70s movies, this is the place for you, Clem Marie.
Yes. Oh, I got to maybe look up some movies for my dad because, you know, he also loves the 70s. There's this great picture of my parents dressed. My dad's wearing a white leisure suit. My mom has long blonde hair. Her hair is naturally darker than mine. And I like this black slinky dress. They'll probably really be embarrassed that I mentioned this, but they probably don't listen to this, even though I posted it on my Facebook. Anyhow.
Go for it.
Yes. Oh, that'd be awesome. So tickling my fancy today, aside from old funny pictures of my parents, is an important book, but not a fun book. But it's actually, honestly, one of the best books I have ever read. It is King Leopold's Ghost, a story of greed, terror, and heroism
I've
in
read
colonial
this. It's really
Africa.
Good and depressing.
Yes, it is really good and depressing. It is the story. So in the 1880s, King Leopold of Belgium owned the Congo, owned central Colombia.
Yeah, like 1/4 of Africa or something?
Yes.
Most of Central Africa.
It was most
owned.
Of Central Africa at the time. And what it was a genocidal regime because colonialism is designed to extract resources and people and resources from a place. So that is what he did and then some in pursuit of the rubber trade and of minerals and of laying down railroads. A lot of the Congolese, the natives of the region, were killed. So it's a horrific story. The book also details the campaign against King Leopold's regime and the colony that arose in the late 19th century and early of 20th century. The book follows. The book is by Adam Hochschild. The book follows, in particular, three men that were instrumental in bringing the truth about the Belgian Congo to the rest of the world. Edmund Morel, a young British shipping agent, and two Black Americans. George Washington Williams and William Shepard, one of whom was a minister and one of whom was working for the Belgian Congo. And it sort of details how their accounts led to the eventual international campaign against the Belgian Congo. This is honestly one of the best books I've ever read. It is a story that will honestly stop you in your tracks. It is not a fun book. It's the kind of thing where I listened to the audiobook version on our Overdrive app, which also it apparently was directly transferred from the cassette version. So you would be listening. And this is end of cassette one.
Nice.
Please turn over cassette now. So it said this, on my Overdrive app. So
little
every
audio hits.
Yeah, little audio hits. So like, oh, look at that, back in the day. But so I listened to the audiobook version, very well narrated.
That narrator is Jeffrey Howard.
We also have the print version, which also includes, of course, pictures.
Yeah, I was about to say the book version, if you want to be really depressed, you can look at the pictures of what they did to the poor Africans there. It was really
huge
downer.
For those of you that are perhaps a little familiar with the Belgian Congo, the King Leopold's regime was known for taking off the hands of natives who did not collect enough rubber.
They didn't meet their quota. They were disfigured for life.
Yes, exactly. So this is the kind of thing I was listening to. Oh, I got to stop now. But it is honestly one of the best books I've ever read. If you want to know something about basically a history that's been hidden, it's been obscured, history about the race for Africa by Europe for colonial holdings, read this book. I know that was a bit of a downer, but it's important. But yes.
So Hochschild wrote a book a few years ago called To End All Wars, A Story of Loyalty and Rebellion, 1914 to 1918.
Yes, I have not read it.
So that was one of the better books about World War I I've read in the last few years. And what that was about was the biographies of people who were actually dissenters during World War I when they were very, very few. You know, it was a different time. It was like a different time. It was like people like... were not cool to be unpatriotic or have a minority report about a war. And that book was really, really fascinating, and all the people that were in it were exceptional human beings.
Yes.
Whose stories needed to be told.
Yeah, and I found the same in this book, in King Leopold's Ghost. I think Adam Hochschild, I really liked his writing. He was, I think, also the book was wonderfully researched, that he made an effort to try to include even stories and accounts of Africans. And he made a point of saying that this happened in Africa, and but their accounts and their histories are obscured. And also in the book, Joseph Conrad makes an appearance, and
Heart of Darkness.
And Adam Hochschild makes the point that although we talk about Heart of Darkness, about this story about, you know, it's this universal story about, you know, the depravity of humankind and all that stuff, that no, it's actually about Central Africa, and it's a colonial literature. So it was really good. Adam Hochschild has written another book recently. It came out, Spain in Our Hearts, about Americans at the Spanish Civil War. I have checked it out. I had to wait for it. So apparently people were waiting for it, and it is good. So I'm going to read it.
Read that. All right.
Yes.
The Abraham Lincoln Brigade, y'all.
Yes, exactly. Fighting against fascism.
What do you got, Jeremy?
Speaking of fascism, I get all these segwayables.
You're welcome.
Yeah. Tickling my fancy this week is The Great Outdoors.
That ain't the last bite.
Well, sure it is. There's nothing on that plate but gristle and fat.
Not the John Candy joint.
I was about to say the one with like John Candy and the bear with like
actually, or butt. Actually going outside.
Yeah, actually going outside.
What's that?
Tell me about it.
Tickle my fancy.
Tell me about it. Scratching.
Tickle my non-fancy.
Scratching my unhappy.
Scratching the no.
Normally, I like to scratch my unhappy, but but. Instead of it's
too many
the opposite,
jokes, like my brain froze
it's
for
the
a
opposite
second.
Of tickling
sorry.
My fancy. How
I
about
Brian's right? We just derail you.
How about let's change it? Scratching my casual.
It didn't get better. I don't want to scratch your casual either.
That's better, right? Scratching my casual.
Gouging my disinterest, maybe.
Yeah. There you go.
Well, so I've lived in Nashville for 10 years. In August, I'll have lived in Nashville for 10 years, and most of that time has been spent in my house or at the library. And so, like, in the last month, I've gone on a hike around Radnor Lake, and that was wonderful, except I wanted to throw my son in it. But this past week...
That would make it funner.
Why did you want to throw your son in the
lake? Oh, just because he was, like, dragging his feet and wouldn't come on, wouldn't stay off.
He didn't want to scratch his casual.
Yeah. He wanted to find if his son could float.
No, yeah. They all float down here.
Yeah.
Kept going off the path, and, like, you know, it says there's poison ivy everywhere, and I'm like, I don't want to put cream on this kid. You know, because he's going to be scratching his casual and it's going to get all over. So, there you go.
I'm trying to make it a thing.
There you go. It's a thing. I made it up.
Gouging.
Gouging is unhappy. I guess all I got, unhappy and casual. Those are the two words that describe me the most.
Disinterest.
It's called a thesaurus.
This past weekend, we went pontooning with some friends. A friend of a friend has a pontoon boat, and we took a pontoon out onto Percy Priest Lake. My son called it Percy Prius Lake because his grandma drives a Prius. Because
it's environmentally sound.
Exactly. So, it wasn't. So we went out to an island, and it was all beautiful. We went there and had lunch. Some jerk faces left, like, beer cans and cigarette butts and broken glass everywhere.
Nice.
So we took some of that. And then we went to it.
Don't pollute.
Exactly. This is a beautiful place. Very lovely, but don't leave trash. What are you? How much trouble does it take to put trash in a bag?
Leave only footprints.
Exactly. Just your breath. You know.
Somewhere in a Italian American playing an Indian is crying.
Exactly. A hair and some air. A hair and some air. So we went to another part. This little cove that was shaded. Oh yeah, that's the other thing. So I am technically a white guy, but I'm actually more red because I'm just permanently burned by the sun. So.
I spent the day with like a hat on, sunscreen all over me, and then like a long sleeve shirt covering my body so I wouldn't burn.
It was 95 degrees last weekend.
Yeah, yeah, it's fine. We were in the shade. I had shorts on and flip flops. And I was covered in sunscreen too. I did not burn and it was great. But so we were in this shaded cove and everybody was swimming, and my friend was like reaching down, and the kids were all picking up rocks and throwing them. And my friend reached down and picked up some stuff, and he made this face and he pulled up a bone. He pulled up a bone. It was obviously like a leg bone, maybe.
Some sort of Stand By Me moment now.
Probably of an animal, we're assuming. Hopefully. But the next thing he picked up was a shoe, and that was crazy.
Whoa!
I think I'm getting out at that point.
Yeah, holy moly.
And then he's like, oh my God, I found the skull.
364.1523 game.
Forensic files. Wait, you say it. You say it, Mike.
Files.
Anyway, it was a good time even without the bone, and coupled with the enormous stress that my family had actually getting our stuff together to go there, we had a wonderful day. So I recommend taking advantage, not waiting 10 years to take advantage of all the beauty that the Nashville area has to offer. Corrections! I have a correction.
Oh.
Just a note. That was Metallica's Master of Puppets that was playing during the outtakes of the last episode.
In case you didn't know.
I didn't know that.
Also, I should talk into the mic more when I'm not talking into the mic and making off-mic comments.
Yes.
Just for the record. Are there any other corrections? Cliff Burton rules?
Pre-Injustice for All Metallica is the best Metallica. Yeah.
Jason Newsted got robbed on that bass mix. For more information about bass mixes, you can go to
www.library.nashville.org.
And our theme music is by
Adam Dean.
Next week.
Physical fitness?
No, guys, we're celebrating America's birthday early because who knows how many more the old girl has in her. Hooray!
Hey! Move to Canada, y'all.
Yeah.
Cake.
There will be cake. Let them eat cake, I think somebody said.
Yes, yes. Oh, history repeating.
2 Minutes TV Games for all sorts of cool game videos. We do top fives, and we aren't afraid to get a little naughty.
Barf, barf, barf.